And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recyclable paper handy. And let's get right into our weekly commentary. This one's entitled, Logging Shift South Brings Concern on Oversight, written by Douglas Jehl, J-E-H-L, of the New York Times Company. And I believe this was written on August 8th. Union Mills, North Carolina. In a major shift, timber companies have stepped up logging operations in the South, where they face less regulation than in the carefully monitored forests of the Pacific Northwest. Timber harvest in North Carolina, Tennessee, 11 other southern states increased by 50% from 1977 to 1997, from 6.8 billion with a B cubic feet to 10.2 billion cubic feet. According to a draft of a federal report, the Southern Resources Assessment, and the trend has accelerated. Today, the states from Virginia west through Texas account for two-thirds of the 16 billion cubic feet of timber harvested in the United States. Industry officials said almost all of the logging in the South has been conducted responsibly, oh, I'm sure, and they point to the very forest now being cut as an example of that stewardship. Most southern forests, they say, were logged extensively as long as a century ago and then cut again in successive logging cycles. Federal officials and industry critics said the geographic shift reflected at least in part the relative permissiveness of the South, where most forests are in private, not public hands, and where logging is subject to few regulations. In general, southern states have given free rein to logging on private land, in contrast to the West, where state regulations are stricter and where the abundance of federally owned forests means cutting must meet tight federal guidelines. Nearly 70% of the 214 million acres of forest in the South is held by private non-industrial owners, with an additional 20% owned by the forest products industry. In North Carolina, which is typical of southern states, logging on private land does not require state approval, and the state does little to monitor the extent of timber harvests. As a result, federal officials and industry critics said they are seeing several troubling trends. For the first time, softwoods like pine are being harvested faster than they can be replaced, and projections in the Southern Resources Assessment suggested that the more valuable hardwoods face a similar fate. Officials also pointed to a wider use of clear-cutting operations that have laid bare vast tracts of forest. The relentless appetite for wood is being fed by an economy that has produced a strong market for construction. Sounds like Union Mills in western North Carolina have felt the boom in the form of chip mills, like the one here owned by the Willamette Industries Incorporated of Oregon, that grind wood into chips for making paper. More than 100 such mills have sprung up across the South in the last 15 years, most since 1995. Among those concerned about the shift in logging has been the chief of the United States Forest Service, Mike Dombeck. Over the past 20 years, Mr. Dombeck said in a speech in June to a group of writers, a large surplus of the growth of timber over harvest in the South has all but been eliminated. The issue is a question of basic sustainability, Mr. Dombeck said. Harvest levels cannot exceed growth if forests are to continue providing healthy fish and wildlife habitats, clean and pure drinking water, and scenic beauty. In the South, according to federal estimates, the growth deficit is widest on land owned by the timber industry, which is about 20% of the forest, and where removals in 1997 exceeded growth by 15%. Even in cases where forests are being replanted, as is encouraged but rarely required in southern states, it is often with varieties like fast-growing loblolly pine, a tree that is a valuable commercial crop but one that biologists say is less likely to promote animal habitat than naturally mixed forests. Timber industry officials said the concerns are groundless and that most logging was being conducted with an eye to the future health not only of the forest but of the industry. They also acknowledged that in isolated cases, too much timber had been cut too fast with too little thought about what replaced the existing forest. But logging, they said, is the only way to clear old, marginal timber and make way for healthier, newer trees. Quote, you have a resource that's getting old and its growth is slowing and the removals are increasing, said Bob Slocum, executive vice president of the North Carolina Forestry Association and Industry Group. Quote, you might have a period where your removals are exceeding growth, Mr. Slocum says. Important to remember that timber in the South was extensively cut in the early 20th century and that it is, again, time for harvesting. I would argue that the more important issue is what happened to the land after harvest, he said. If it stays in forestry, you're going to be okay, but if you pave it over, if you replace it with a Home Depot or a Walmart, it's going to be lost. Industry critics have cited the speed and scope of the logging in the 13 states as their main concerns. The basic fact is the southeastern states were ill-prepared for the extreme for this incredible acceleration of timber products, says Lark Hayes, who, as a senior lawyer for the Southern Environmental Law Center, has helped to lead an effort to impose greater controls over timber operations. Earlier this year, Missouri, under Governor Mel Carnahan, imposed a 2-year moratorium on permits for chip mills. North Carolina is also considering a moratorium as part of a study ordered by Governor Jim Hunt. But it is in small communities like Union Mills where the newest outrage can be heard. Quote, we're not a bunch of tree huggers, and we do want to use the forest, Carolyn J. Edwards, a seventh-generation North Carolina resident who works as a soil scientist, forest management consultant, said in the county seat town of Rutherfordden, North Carolina, not far from Union Mills. But we want to use it wisely. Shannon A. Buckley, who is a district procurement forester for Willamette in western North Carolina, has been at the center of a local fight, offering a contrasting view that restrictions of logging would be a blow to property rights. It's all got to come from a willing seller, Mr. Buckley said of the 300,000 tons of wood chips the mill could produce each year for Willamette's expanded papermaking operations in Kentucky and Tennessee. If the landowners don't want to sell the wood, it's not going to happen. Nationally, groups like the Southeast Forest Project have tried to pressure Vice President Al Gore, as an environmental advocate and a native of Tennessee, to address concerns about southern forests. In his comments, Mr. Dombeck has been careful to point out that the widespread private ownership of southern forests means there may be little the government can do. Quote, these are not public lands I'm talking about, and we will not try to regulate private forest land, Mr. Dombeck said in a recent speech to members of the American Forest and Paper Association. I challenge you, the world's foremost leaders in private forest management, to show leadership on this issue. The Southern Resources Assessment, which should be completed next year, is expected to provide a more detailed look at southern forests. But one picture of the transformation can be gleaned from periodic estimates by the Forest Service, which tries to gauge the nation's timber supply. In 1977, the studies show the growth of timber stock in the South exceeded harvest by 75%, but by 1997, the most recent year for which statistics are available, the gap had dropped to less than 5% as harvest increased and growth declined. Among softwoods region-wide, a large surplus in 1977 changed to a deficit of 10% in 1997. Among hardwoods like oak, hickory, and poplar, the surplus has also dropped, prompting researchers to warn that these woods will also fall into deficit within the next decade if the current increase in logging remains unchecked. And though 20 years ago about 15% of the nation's timber production came from national forests, mostly in the Northwest, that figure has dropped below 5%, driven by a series of federal decisions aimed at protecting the environment and, in particular, the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan, crafted to meet a court-ordered directive to save the endangered spotted owl. But across most of the country, logging in the South takes place far from cities and the interstates. But the view from the air can offer a more vivid picture, exposing one checkerboard after another with patches of natural forest interspersed by tracks raised to bare earth and by others whose uniform green is a telltale sign of the planting of a single variety of tree. On one recent afternoon in the rugged Timberland Plateau not far from Chattanooga in southeastern Tennessee, the extent of the leveling was particularly vivid and appeared to support the findings of one federal research project whose conclusions suggested that in particular cases, the broad brush estimates might not reflect the severity of timber loss. It is very clear that more broadly, no one really yet knows exactly what is going on, said Jonathan Evans, a biologist at the University of the South who is director of the federal project, which focused on impoverished rural Grundy County, and found that the county lost 12% of its hardwood habitat from 1981 to 1998. Among particular points of dispute is whether the chip mills are part of the problem. Only 32 of the more than 150 chip mills existed before 1985, but the timber industry officials say the increase represents a step towards efficiency by making it possible to ship pulpwood to paper mills as chips instead of as logs. There's a demand out there that's going to be met, said Mr. Slocum of the Forestry Association. As a corollary benefit, foresters like Mr. Buckley say the mills provide a market for scrap wood that otherwise would have had little commercial value. thus encouraging an overhaul they say is necessary to make way for healthier forests. But the environmental groups and their allies see mills more as instruments of an assault on southern forests whose only guide is the corporate bottom line. The Dogwood Alliance, a group formed to protect southern forests, has estimated that more than 1.2 millions of acres of forest a year, or about 1,500 square miles, is needed to feed the chip mills now in operation. In operations of that scale, the critics say, neither time nor attention is given to selective logging measures aimed at promoting natural habitat. Quote, personally, I've always waited until the trees get big, and only then do I saw them, said Rodney Robbins, a 44, a third-generation logger from Union Mills. Quote, but these timber companies only see one way of doing things. They just want to go in and mow everything down. Once again, this has been commentary written by Douglas Geel of the New York Times, and we thank him and the New York Times for this commentary. All right, let's get back into action alerts. Montana Old Growth Action Alert. The future of old growth forests in Montana State Forests is on the line, and the state is accepting public comment through September 22nd on three options for the management of old growth forests. Please send a letter or email to the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation supporting option 3, the conservation alternative. I'm not going to read all of this, but what can you do? Please write the Montana Land Board and ask them to select option 3 to guide old growth management and protect forest biodiversity on state forests. As much of the best old growth forest is in northwestern Montana, transboundary wildlife populations may be affected by continued logging of old growth forests, so letters from Canada are as valid as U.S. letters. Here is the address. State Board of Land Commissioners, Box 201601, Helena, Montana, 59620. That address again, State Board of Land Commissioners, Box 201601, Helena, Montana, 59620. And again, support option 3. You can also send email to LP Green, that's LPGREENE, at state.mt.us. And of course, if you'd like more information, you can contact Steve at the Montana Old Growth Project. Probably have to send phone or email at this point. 406-862-3795. That's 406-862-3795. Or you can send email to sthomp at digisys.net. That's digisys.net. And help save some forest up there in Montana. Here in the state of California, on Friday, September 8th, the California Department of Forestry approved the first of six controversial Maxam Pacific Lumber timber harvest plans for the Rainbow Ridge area of the Mattole. Rainbow Ridge, located in the Mattole River watershed of the Lost Coast, harbors the largest unprotected contiguous lowland old-growth Douglas fir forest in California. This is the first of the so-called sacrifice zones in which PL is allowed under the terms of the Headwater Deal Habitat Conservation Plan to ignore the Endangered Species Act. This area is home to coho salmon, steelhead trout, river otters, northern goshawks, peregrine falcons, Pacific fishers, and a small rural community. It is a pristine, remote, very steep and rugged 14,000-acre mix of forest and prairie, receives an average of 100 inches of rainfall annually, much of it in concentrated deluges. That means it rains like hell out there. It is also one of the most seismically active regions in the United States. Continuing landslides occur from 1985 clear cuts, generating enormous quantities of sediment in the Mattole's North Fork, intensified by seasonal flooding. Despite the Endangered Species Act exemption, plaintiffs argue that the devastation of this old-growth forest is illegal on numerous grounds. And the Humboldt Watershed Council, the Lost Coast League, and the Environmental Protection Information Agent Center filed a complaint in Humboldt County Superior Court last Friday. They were told they could not get a hearing before September 15th to request for a temporary restraining order. Since Maxam could have started logging on the 11th of September, the plaintiffs went to the state appellate court in San Francisco so the trees would not be sacrificed before they could get a hearing. The plaintiffs were granted a stay of logging, which protects the forest until the next court hearing, which is likely to happen tomorrow, September 15th. Meanwhile, there are five other timber plans in the hopper. I believe I gave you these numbers last week, but let's go through them again. In California, they're called THPs, Timber Harvest Plans, THP1-00-218, 1-98-260, 1-00-020, 1-00031, and 1-00342, and 1-00309. I hope you got all those. I'm not repeating them. These all could imminently be approved. So please pressure the state to deny these other plans and encourage Maxam to grant us a one-year moratorium on logging on Rainbow Ridge while the community works to raise funds to acquire this area. Here's the contact. Please contact Susan Kennedy, Governor Davis's Deputy Chief of Staff. Her phone number, 916-445-6131. That's 916-445-6131 or 916-445-1456. If you'd like to send a fax, it's 916-445-4633. Let Ms. Kennedy know how you feel about preserving this magnificent ancient forest and that no entity is above the law. If you'd like more information, you can contact EPIC at 707-923-2931. That's 707-923-2931. Or, of course, www.wildcalifornia.org. Or you can call the North Coast Timber Hotline, 707-441-3828. That's 707-441-3828. Meanwhile, CDF is proposing new rules for state logging. I got this from the San Jose Mercury News September 14th issue. That's today. Written by John Howard. This starts out, Sacramento, California forestry officials struggling to please loggers and environmentalists. I doubt they'll do either. Propose new rules Wednesday that include easing timber restrictions on thousands of acres of forest. But the Board of Forestry said in a final decision on the complex package, a sort of mix-and-match plan with various parts and a raft of last-minute amendments would not be made until October. Those are the infamous October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Board of Forestry meetings. A decision is required then if the rules are to go into effect in January as planned. Earlier, board members appeared likely to support regulations drafted largely by timber interests that would allow a greater level of logging than is permitted under current rules. But the members became increasingly divided as new options were offered throughout the day and decided on the postponement Wednesday night. The board extended the current rules originally adopted in March until the end of next year at its meeting Tuesday. At issue are rules that essentially determine how much logging can be done near streams. Environmentalists say any logging within a certain number of feet from a stream bed threatens a complex ecosystem that supports fish and other life. Loggers contend that the rules, which target even the smallest streams, would put so much forest land off limits to loggers that their livelihoods would be threatened. Environmentalists generally favor the current rules, if they were enforced, that is. Loggers have gotten behind the Watershed Evaluation and Mitigation Addendum, which would regulate the amount of logging in forests according to particular watersheds rather than stream by stream. Environmentalists contend that the WEMA would make it easier for loggers to harvest more timber. Forestry interests maintain that the proposal meets environmental safeguards and is financially responsible. That is, they'll continue to make money. If the board votes next month to allow the WEMA option, timber interests and landowners could have a choice on how to obtain the necessary approvals to cut timber, either through the existing rules or through WEMA. But environmentalists say that WEMA regulations could remove limits on key aspects of logging, including how many trees must be left standing near streams, how much canopy must be retained overhead for shade, and how close to streams loggers are allowed to cut. They fear the new option would hurt fish and wildlife. Quote, that's what all these hearings are about, whether the loggers will have to leave 10 trees standing alongside the stream for every 330 feet, or whether the buffer zones around streams will be bigger or smaller, said Kathy Bailey of the Sierra Club. Timber and agricultural interests say the cost to landowners of keeping trees out of harvest plus the cost of environmental studies are too high. The temporary regulations, quote, are burdensome and unnecessary, said Rhonda Lucas of the California Farm Bureau Federation. Quote, we have a lot of small, non-industrial landowners who do logging and have cattle, and they just can't afford this, she said. They don't cut every single year, and they are second and third and fourth generation families. Tom Nelson of Sierra Pacific Industries, boo hiss, said the existing rules are onerous, suggesting that because of logging restrictions, quote, 35% of our land is not managed for timber production, a figure that he said could go higher. Nelson also said the board, quote, promised a viable alternative when the temporary rules were adopted in March. Moving to Canada, an action alert. Canada recently allowed the total of 12 beluga whales caught in Russia to be imported to a Canadian aquarium for public display. While Canada has finally begun to prohibit the capture and imprisonment of its own whales, incredibly, it has no prohibitions or regulations governing the import of marine mammals. All that is required is an export permit from the country of origin. Herb Dhaliwal, I guess, Canada's federal minister of fisheries and oceans, claims his government has no means or authority to prevent such imports. However, legal advisors to the animal protection community assert that Dhaliwal's contention is absurd. The government does have authority to prohibit the import of marine mammals. Please write to Herb Dhaliwal, that's Dhaliwal, Canada's federal minister of fisheries and oceans, and ask him to, quote, make official the ban on the take of marine mammals in Canadian waters for domestic or foreign display, and to ban the import of marine mammals from other countries for captive display. Here's the address. The Honorable Herb Dhaliwal, Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, House of Commons, Parliament Buildings, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, K1A0A6. That address again. The Honorable Herb Dhaliwal, Dhaliwal, Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, House of Commons, Parliament Buildings, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And, of course, the Canadian equivalent of the zip code is K1A0A6. Or if you want to send email, it's dhalih@parl.gc.ca. And, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news today. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or you can send your letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send those announcements 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Download the player and listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz at any time, and you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web. That site is www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. And the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free radio stations and non-commercial radio stations, and please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. You can also catch Earth First Radio on Franklin's Tower Web Radio, that email address, www.unbrokenchain.net/Franklin's Tower, all one word. That's www.unbrokenchain.net/Franklin's Tower. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Stefan. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some music from Jim Page. This one is off his CD called Whose World Is This? And guess what? That's what the song's called. Whose World Is This?
Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows, and everybody wants to know. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire. Funny how we all conspire. We don't know, 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world would our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never receive one? Said and done. What kind of creed must we come to believe if they are ever to receive one? Four winds, seven seas. Relative humanity. Everywhere I look, I see.